My top five podcasters, Chris Lambert, and probably myself, but this ain't about that. The Mundane Festival is where you're at. If you've been tapped in, you know what's up. If you're a first timer, hey, welcome to the club. The cost of admission is simply a subscription, then rating and reviewing it wherever you listen. Don't worry about change ups, the cast won't break up. Even when that $1 million contract show up, a stand up guy who's a stand up comedian with a stance on everything from food to media. So welcome to the show, please take your seat. Let's find out what he's got in store this week. Who, me? I'm Don Will, your opening act. Thanks for coming out. Please clap. The Mundane Festival. With your host, Chris Lambert.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert, recording this on Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast listening apparatus. If you're really into this thing, go over to Apple Podcasts, give this show a 5-star review, let everybody know why you like it, because it's simply the right thing to do. And if you want to take your love and appreciation of this show to an even deeper level, go over to patreon.com/mundanefestival. Subscribe, $3 a month for hours and hours and hours and hours of bonus content. This is episode 560. I have a very special guest that you know and you love, Dr. Veronica Paredes. We're here. We're going to talk about a couple movies, and we're going to mainly do nerd out on, give a spoiler-filled review on Koganada's latest film, After Yang. Veronica, how the heck are you?
Doing good, Chris. Doing good. It's good to be here with you. How are you feeling today, right now, this moment?
I am doing okay. Now that I'm talking to you, I feel a lot better. I'm doing all right. So yeah. What's it been like for you? Are you ending of a quarter this week, right?
Yeah, it's the end of the term. So we're ending the winter quarter and having a very short spring break. And then I think it's like a week or a couple of days, and then the spring quarter. So yeah, it's been nice. And that, like, it's been, I mean, you can't complain about it being cold. It's sunny right now. It's been sunny. It's got like that kind of feel a little bit for a while, you know, and I never felt a winter into spring than like what you feel when you're in New York, you know, the kind of feeling. And then when that was happening here, this is maybe like a month ago, people were also coming out of COVID or feeling like Omicron was done. So it was kind of like people are excited to be back out gathering with one another. So that was kind of novel for like a week. And now it's just kind of trying to finish the quarter. I don't know. Do you have that experience, like that winter, the first warm day out of winter that used to happen?
Right? With global warming and everything. I mean, hell, a month ago, I was doing some shows down in Richmond, and it was 71 degrees. And a couple days ago, it was in the 70s. And then it's snowing in New York as we speak. And
I didn't know that.
It's raining. Like, I'm recording this in Maryland on my end, but it's all over the place. It's crazy.
Yeah. So then you get like a day where it's really warm, and then it'll get really cold again. Plants don't know what to do. And
yeah,
it puts kind of a damper on that. Like, I don't know. You were in New York for some days when it was like everyone's kind of out and they are so excited to not be wearing a winter jacket and all that.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a magical kind of day, right?
The sundresses come out. I mean, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
It's so weird that it's, you know, but we are in near March. What is it? What do they say? March goes in like a lamb, out like a lion.
I've never heard that phrase before.
Never heard that term.
Heard that weather. Saying.
Yeah. Some people have heard that before. Don't make me look like an idiot. No, but it's...
I grew up in California. We don't talk about the weather that much here. So it's not until I moved to the Midwest where, like, or New York. Well, not even New York, more the Midwest. We talk about the weather a lot, right?
You're probably right. You're a West Coast girl, so I get it. I totally understand.
Yeah, but I like it. It goes like a... Wait, comes in like a what?
In like a lamb, out like a lion.
Interesting. Okay.
So by the time March is done, it will have a couple snowstorms, maybe.
I see. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that one. It's interesting. So, yeah, what are we going to, we're going to talk about After Yang and maybe start by talking about some things that we're listening to and watching.
Whatever you want to do. I think I always like to know what my guests are watching and just have them talk about it for a little bit. You know the drill.
Yeah.
You've got your five timers jacket is in the mail. I think you've done it even more than that, I think.
Oh, that'd be nice. I get like a, what is it? If you played football, the Letterman jacket. The Letterman's or something? Jacket.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be nice.
We don't have the budget. This is a small outfit. One day.
I'd like to be part of a club with a jacket. That'd be cool. Bowling team. Anyway, what have I been listening? So I watched a lot since we last talked. I watched the Weenie Talked About Cosby documentary series. I watched the first season of Morning Show, but I didn't finish. I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to finish it, the second season.
I get it. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't like how they did Goo Goo, but it was in the script.
Me neither.
You know,
I didn't like it. I felt like very annoyed by it. Anyway, I watched, finished Righteous Gemstones.
Oh, sure.
And continued watching like Abbott Elementary, Grand Crew, and This Is Us. But I also started watching, so After Party ended.
Yes.
Right. So I watched that.
What'd and
now
think?
I've been watching. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I like that they're going to continue for season two with Tiffany Haddish. I think that's really interesting.
I think her episode framework. Was the best one. I loved her episode. It was it was good. It was funny, especially like that. The old woman who she interviewed at like when the girl stole her egg
pod. Egg pod. Oh, yeah, that was funny.
So funny. Yeah.
I don't know. We won't spoil it, but I kind of didn't expect what happened.
Oh, well.
I mean, if I would have taken, it's just like, it wasn't a show where it emphasized so much the whodunit or speculation about like whodunit. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was going to be an out of left field person.
And right. Then,
yeah. I thought they tied that up nicely. It was kind of a nice payoff. And it's obvious that they had been thinking about it the entire time and weaving things throughout the series. So
yeah,
it might be a fun one to return to like previous episodes.
Sure. Yeah. I liked it a lot.
Yeah. So after that ended, I've been watching Severance that Ben Stiller directed, Adam Scott, and who else, you know, that one about,
how is it?
Yeah, I enjoy it. I think it's interesting. It's a workplace kind of sci-fi, science fiction comedy. It's bleak, it's dystopic, brings up a lot of issues. So I think it would be like a good one to teach with.
Cool.
But otherwise, also, it's a compelling plot. I'm curious about what's happening. All the ensemble is really good comedically. So it's a good show. You haven't been interested? Yeah.
No, I'm interested in it. It's just that there's so much stuff. It's just like, oh, and then I want to try to focus on it. Like I was telling you about that show also on Apple TV Plus, Suspicion. That's like, it's good. It's solid. But it's like, am I really paying attention to this? Or like, right. You know, I just want to be able to focus on something. But yeah, they're all appealing to me. I definitely want to see Severance.
Yeah, it's got some. It brings up a lot of interesting issues about the future of work. So that's been fun to think about.
Sure.
Interesting to think about, bleak to think about. And also The Dropout that I guess it's on Hulu. That's when I was trying to remember. I think Michael Showalter directed a few of the beginning episodes and it's the person.
Elizabeth Holmes. Name?
Yeah, it's a Theranos story.
Amanda Seyfried and Naveen Andrews.
Yes. Which he's very interesting as Sonny. Have you been watching it?
I have. Yeah, I watched the first three.
Now, what'd you think?
I like it. It's interesting because I watched the, what is it? The ABC, the 2020 story on it. I think that was the first time I had heard of it. And then I found out they were making a series. It's interesting. She, it's these scammers, man, these fraudsters.
They love her though. I mean, there's so many different movies and TV shows and podcasts and things about it. So I just wanted to mention that the creator is the creator of New Girl, Elizabeth Merriweather.
Okay.
It's interesting that it's got a comedic shape to it, you know, with that kind of, I was surprised to see so many like comedians or in this first episode or people that I know from comedy. So that was interesting kind of take on the story that I wasn't expecting. And I don't know, it's I listened to the Bad Blood podcast that John Carreyrou hosted that's based on his book. So I'm like, I don't know, just how she did it, the kinds of amplification and exacerbation of like Silicon Valley values and, you know, how inspired she was by Steve Jobs and the ways that she quotes Yoda and like just how it happened, you know, it's so compelling. And like, I mean, it's like, what was that, Fire Festival kind of thing?
Yeah.
But on such a large scale with like people's lives, but it's not so terrible. Like the Dr. Death guy who was like the surgeon who like, you know, operated on people and injured people and like killed people. I mean, this was also had the possibility of really messing with people's lives and health. So I don't know. So that's been a really one that I've been watching as it's been coming out, and I've been enjoying that one. And I really like Amanda Seyfried.
Oh yeah. She's great.
Or Seyfried. Anyway,
whatever. We'll get
so it. She's,
we'll edit
she's
that
great.
In post.
Yeah.
I think she'll get nominated for something. She's been, it's kind of her turn to get some love, you know?
Yeah. So that's what I've been watching. And then just trying to catch up to you, man. Just watching all these nominated films.
I'm trying to catch up to you.
What do you mean? Well, just with one, Drive My Car. I have that one pocket, like one card in my pocket.
I watched it last night. Finished it last night. It's good. I did not expect the things that happened in that movie to happen. I was like, oh shit. Oh, wow. That's crazy. Interesting flick. Did it have to be that long?
Did you feel it? I didn't feel it. I don't know.
I didn't. I was wondering why did it. I mean, but they definitely take their time. Established. It didn't feel that long, but it just, you know, when you look at the timer, you look at the you look at the display and you see how much time you got left, and it's like, well, they're really all right.
Yeah, it didn't feel redundant to me.
Redundant. It wasn't redundant. It was just like
long.
Yeah, I was just wondering what they were getting to, but I guess it was just kind of like him really getting into that role because it scared him. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's a long way around the barn to get to that.
That's how life is though, Chris. It takes a while. It takes some time.
You're right. No, you
process things.
No, you're absolutely right.
But this guy, Ryosuke Hamaguchi, he's going to be in LA, I think soon, maybe later this month. And so I do have some tickets to watch this 5-hour long film that he has.
Holy shit.
Which I don't know. I'm not sure. It's Happy Hour from 2015.
Okay.
And the tickets for Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, which is like the same year. He has two films that are like award nominated in the same year. Those were sold out. So I couldn't buy tickets for that. But Happy Hour, I don't know. It's also available on Criterion. So 5 hours in a theater. See, this is maybe the difference too. I watched Drive My Car in the theater. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't really have a sense of time there, sure. You know.
I would have gone, but I think the play was running at the time when we were texting about it. But yeah, I would have gone to see it.
It's been playing a lot here in LA. Yeah. I don't know if it's been.
It's on HBO Max now. So.
Right. So yeah, I also watched Asako 1 and 2, which I think was available on like maybe Canopy or Criterion. That was from 2018. He's just, I don't know. He's just really interesting the way he tells stories. the complex like timelines he has going on that still feel like they're moving somewhere to me. I can see why you would feel there's like some kind of, you're right, it kind of shifts genres a little bit. There's like information revealed that you wouldn't have expected, or reactions of people that you wouldn't have expected. I don't know. So that I've really dug that. I still have to watch Belfast and Parallel Mothers, but other than that, I'm kind of getting through it. And Macbeth. I still need to watch Macbeth.
I think The Worst Person in the World is the only one I need to see.
And that's only playing in theaters too, right? Is that only, or is that?
Yeah, I think that's the only one on my list that I need to see.
Get through.
Maybe next week if I can sneak out and watch it. Maybe we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. So what have you been watching? What's been going on? Or, you know, you probably had an update with your last podcast talk with someone.
Well, I just saw Drive My Car. I watched this morning, I watched the Lucy and Desi doc on Amazon Prime, which is very good. It's nice to pair it with Being the Ricardos.
Which I watched for you, or I watched for the roundtable we might do. I enjoyed Being the Ricardos more than I thought I would. But you're saying that the documentary, how does it complement it?
It's very well done. I mean, they kind of go from their beginnings for both of them, basically their origin stories. There's tapes that they had, the family participates in it, you know. It's very good. It's really good. Just talking about Lucy, what she meant as an entertainer and how she influenced people like Carol Burnett, Mary Tyler Moore. Mm-hmm. Like, she was a person who was not, it didn't have a problem with mentoring these women coming up, and, you know, always was there to help if she could and stuff like that. So and then Desi about, you know, his stuff, where he came from, all of that. It's really good. It's worth it.
So it gives a lot more context.
Yes. Provides more context. Being the Ricardos was just about a week in their lives. And sometimes those are good too. I like stuff like that. It's like a specific time, a specific place, especially when it's with regards to biopics. It can be really interesting that, you know, it's just this touch point in their life that's really interesting. You know, like where you got Huat going after them, and it's just like this. It refines everything that's done within the world of the film to me, instead of trying to be this sprawling piece that can get a little tedious when it comes to biopics, you know?
Yeah. What was I going to say about that? Oh, what I did enjoy about Being the Ricardos is it was commentary of like, I don't know, I saw a tweet or someone put out like, there was a one-line review in Letterboxd. Like, if I were to do this, maybe I would have made Lucy funny. You know, and I think that was kind of interesting. It's snarky, obviously. It's like the dissenting view about the film. But I thought that what I found really compelling about the film was the ways that it showed how she was choreographing and setting and thinking about, creatively thinking about physical comedy all the time. And the struggles, or, you know, the kinds of ways that she would, you know, push back on directors as talent and as a producer. So I thought those kinds of scenes that focused on the creative process of TV at that moment was really interesting, and how they highlighted Ricky's role, you know, Desi's role of like studio audience, and all those kinds of innovations on the business side were really interesting.
Yeah. You know, I didn't have a really dissenting view on that movie. I just thought, I just liked the way that they intercut those scenes where they were actually filming it and like playing those scenes. I thought that was cool, and I really would have loved to see more, but within the context of the film, that doesn't really work. And the other part I liked about it, and that's a person being kind of snarky anyway, like you said, but it was just kind of like, that was cool the way they did it. And then the way Lucy was just really into deconstructing a scene, trying to figure out what worked, what was funny, how to put things together. I personally am not a person who's like an engineer who can take something apart and put it back together. But that's kind of how I am with acting and with jokes mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So my brain works in that way. So that's what's interesting and exciting for me. Like a lot of times, I think maybe I've said it on the pod before, where I always appreciated and enjoyed the rehearsal process, especially when it comes to theater. Because you can fail there. You know, there's room for failure there and you can learn. That's and then just the performance of the run of the show is to me the icing on the cake, even though you can still learn within the run of a show while, you know, after it opens. But
that's why I like Drive My Car so much, is that they all the rehearsals they went through, the process to get that together, to have all these actors speaking different languages and understand and act with that kind of challenge. It's really fascinating. And I've heard that, you know, he does similar things in his filmmaking, that Hamaguchi does similar kinds of rehearsals and kind of very thorough kinds of preparation.
I remember I had this last year in grad school. This teacher, professor I had, June Compton, was really into Asian theater. This white lady who was really into Asian theater. And we did The Good Woman of Sichuan by Bertolt Brecht. And we incorporated a lot of the Asian culture into that play. And it was almost like you learn this structure and learn by learning this structure, even though it feels rigid and confining, there's a freedom in that also. Mm-hmm. And you learn these rules, so in a lot of ways you can break them. So we kind of, that was something that Asian theater taught me. And I could definitely see that in those scenes. I did like the movie. I think I gave it 3.5 stars. It is very good. I kind of envy their pacing in a lot of ways. Burning was the last, I think that was a Korean film, but Burning was the last thing that I remember being that long. What's the movie that everybody was raving over? The one a year or two ago? What's the Asian movie?
That was Steven Yeun was in it.
No, Steven Yeun was in Burning, but like that other movie.
No, but also Minari. It wasn't, it's American. But
not Minari. Oh my God. The movie that about the class. Oh my God. It won the
Oscar. Parasite. You're saying Parasite. Class.
Was that?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
When was that? That wasn't that long, right? Parasite. I mean,
let's see, runtime 2 hours and 12 minutes.
No, that wasn't that long.
Yeah. And Burning. I don't feel like Burning is that long. Let's see.
Burning was like 3 hours.
Was it? Let's see.
Yeah, Burning was
2 hours and 28 minutes.
What? No.
Yes, Chris. Yes.
No.
Uh-huh. That's what Google tells me right now. Yeah, that's only like 15 minutes longer than Parasite. Yes.
I don't believe you. Okay. 148 minutes.
Now you got it all confused. Yeah, it's 2:28.
Okay. Well, it was long. All right. I stand corrected.
There's another thing to think about. Like, why does this feel longer to you?
Because I'm fucking reading, Veronica. I'm fucking reading on the screen. I'm American. I don't know.
Maybe it's got something to do with the editing. I mean, I think, you know, Bong Joon-ho is like, so he's been... He does thrillers and he does, you know.
It's great. They're both, all those movies that we're talking about are great. So,
yeah. Whereas Burning,
you know. I envy that pacing. Because sometimes these movies, I was just watching this film, Sleepwalker, from 2014. Mm-hmm. That was just, it was interesting. And then it just ends. It just ends. Yeah. It's like, what is it? Like, you set it up, you got solid actors in this thing, and you just kind of end. And you just
third act's hard, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Conclusions are hard to write. Third acts are hard, I imagine.
Yeah.
So what was I gonna, I also thinking about process. So I started watching the Kanye documentary, just like the first episode.
Okay.
But I watched Get Back. You know, we talked about it last time. Like, I had watched one episode, one part of the 3-part Get Back documentary that Peter Jackson had directed, that's on Disney Plus,
about
the Beatles.
Right.
About the Beatles Let It Be album. Chris, I watched that like twice, and it's like 8 hours long.
Wow.
I don't know. There was something about just like watching the music happen and the interpersonal relations and the drama and just like all that in music making. It was fascinating. I loved it. And I like started getting into the Beatles in a way that I'd never done before. I don't care about the Beatles before this, you know?
Sure.
But it's interesting too, because like music fans of like a dominant white perspective, it feels like the Beatles fandom is significant. Like, there's so much material about the Beatles.
Right.
I had not realized how into it people get. So that was interesting. That was a couple of months maybe of my interest was around the Beatles.
Oh, I get it. No, I love that. And that's the thing, like that's the thing that's really compelling to me, especially with the Kanye doc. This, the first two chapters or whatever they call them, the first two acts are incredible. And it's just that process of coming up with, like, him being in the studio with Jay-Z and saying, hey, can I rap on this? Can I, pitching himself to Jay-Z and Jay-Z giving him that approval, and all sorts of moments that are really compelling, whether regardless of how you feel about Kanye, you can, most people can understand having dreams and wanting to achieve something. That's why people love Rocky. That's why people love Rudy, that film.
Yeah.
But this is actually a real guy with some ambition. Yeah.
And problems.
And it's very compelling. It's very compelling. I would say I've just flatly said it's the best documentary I've seen since Hoop Dreams. Especially when it, and then just to kind of whittle away at that statement, one of the best depictions of Black American ambition or black life with a subject, just the with a Black subject just in general. Very compelling.
I mean,
go ahead.
Aside from like the interesting things of like the details of like how he made this, how he learned what he learned, his retainers in the studio space, I mean, I love those details, right? Like watching Scarface listen to Jesus Walk, and like all that stuff, like what they were able to capture. That's what's so amazing about like Let It Be. And so like, well, Get Back. And then so amazing about like what Kuti and Shike were able to gather, right? The 20 years it took to make that. Amazing. And then like you're saying, there's that, like, so fascinating. And then the story of like Donda and like how she cultivates his confidence and is so, I've only seen the first chapter, but seems so aware. Like, you know, he's always been self-absorbed. You know, like, he's aware of like him, but at the same time knows that, I don't know, like you're saying, a certain amount of that is necessary to counteract the negativity, the oppression that, you know, is put on Black subjectivity.
I could relate to that. Like my dad was my Donda in a lot of ways. He was, not to say my mother didn't believe, but I think my dad just because my mother would always say, well, your dad used to say, you know, my mother would be excited to come see my shows in high school, and my dad was like, oh, it ain't gonna be nothing or whatever. She would say that to try to like get me against my dad or whatever. But there was a real realization that my father had when I was in college, my freshman year of college, and he saw me in this production of Misanthrope, and where it's a play by Molière about the main character is this guy named Alceste, who is this, who's a misanthrope. And that's why the play, I played his friend. And it was like, it was it was by Molière, but it was translated by this guy named Richard Wilbur, who had the everything in verse. And it was a very talky play, and you're hitting the beats and all that. And once he saw me in that, that's when he was like, oh, I mean, I've always showed up to your shit to be a supportive parent. But he's like, oh, OK. All right. This is who this
kid is.
There's
some talent here. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and ever since then, you know, I was 19 at the time. And then he was really locked in. So he made sure that I was able to do what I'm doing now. Like one of the last major things he did was he paid for me to get my SAG card. He paid for the rest of the initial initiation fee. And he believed. So that was sometimes that's all it takes to where you kind of feel unbeatable when you have that support from somewhere, whatever source it is, where you're not afraid to fail. My dad would just say, you know, you're good. You're already you're a star, but you just need a break. You just need a break. I know you can do it. You know, he's like, I look at some of these people on TV and they're not, but whatever. but Chike and Cootie, they're known for, prior to this, they're known for that this 30 for 30 doc that they did called Benji, about a basketball player that was murdered before he could, you know, achieve his stardom. In Chicago. And then they did this film that I raved over called A Kid from Coney Island, which I did not know until a couple of weeks ago. And I didn't realize, I was like, oh my God, they made this. And it was great, about Stephon Marbury. So these guys, I mean, they know what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, and they make that, where did they say that in the doc, that, you know, they were inspired by Hoop Dreams, or was that in an interview?
I think they might have been.
Yeah,
they had to.
Yeah, I think they said so. I think it was in the doc. He says, you know, I realized that this was something that I had to do. You know, Cootie kind of narrating.
Yeah.
Because he was a star, and you know, this was only once in a lifetime opportunity to capture this moment.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the small town stuff of like the kind of representing Chicago and all those things. It's just so compelling.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like it really, I know people have issues with them, but I mean I can see that side of that. I understand what that's like. I mean, it's a beautiful trilogy. I think, you know, the second one, you know, it kind of ties things together, but if they would have just done one or part, like, because Cootie, I think in one moment he said in the film, and he said, yeah, I was just thinking, like, you know, him winning the Grammy, he made it and that's it, you know, but there, you know, there was more. I'm going to rewatch it, but it's very good. It's very good.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So that's the stuff. Should we get into After Yang? Should we do it?
Let's get into After Yang. I'm going to read the letterboxed blurb and we'll just have at it. And this is going to be, I mean, there's probably you, me, and maybe one or two other nerds that are into Koganada that listen to this, but we're going to do what we do. So, I mean, it's going to be spoiler filled. So I'm just warning you from here on in, we're spoiling this film. And really, there's not that much. Anyway, we're just going to get into it. When his young daughter's beloved companion, an android named Yang, malfunctions, Jake searches for a way to repair him. In the process, Jake discovers the life that has been passing in front of him, reconnecting with his wife and daughter across a distance he didn't know was there. This film was written and directed by Koganada. It's based on a book of short stories called Children of the New World by Alexander Weinstein. The story is called Saying Goodbye to Yang. Dr. Veronica Paredes, what are your thoughts on this film?
Yeah, when I first watched it, I watched it in a special kind of screening where Koganada was there. Justin H. Min, who plays Yang, was there. So it was like my first perspective or take on it was very positive. Mm-hmm. And I think it is like formally an amazing film. You know, I think that it seems like it's a lot more expensive and a lot more at stake in some ways in doing a genre film like this, from Columbus to After Yang. Mm-hmm. But I thought that he did, you know, I was just rooting for Koganada to do well. And I think he did well in this film, as far as like formally telling a story, having a lot of really interesting cinematographic, you know, collaborations with the DP, visualizations of science fiction. In one moment in the film, they go inside the memories of Yang, and the way that that was visualized was really, I thought, virtuosic and well done. I've had some time to think about it some more, and I there were some kinds of questions around like Asian identity that I wanted mm-hmm. to maybe hear him talk about in the Q&A that didn't come up. It was more focused on like filmmaking.
Yeah,
and I did read a review in The New Yorker that Jane Hugh, H-U, had written, what is it called, Where the Future is Asian and the Asians Are Robots, that I thought was really interesting for thinking through some of those questions around Asian mm-hmm. identity and the future in this. Overall, you know, I thought I'm excited about what Koganada is going to do from here. I know that he's working on that series. Based on that Korean epic, like Korean family's epic history or something. He's working on the guy who did Blue Bayou, directed Blue Bayou.
Justin Chan?
Yeah, that dude, Justin Chan. Okay. They're working together on this kind of South Korean epic TV show. We'll find the name of that.
Whatever he's attached to, I'm going to watch.
Oh, you're definitely going to watch this. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you think? What were your initial responses and reactions?
I watched it twice. One, it was kind of like, I got to see it. You know, like I just wanted to see it because it's him. And yeah. I was just like, and then I had to like, I think I was kind of in a hurry to watch it. And I did like it. And I just upgraded my Letterboxd review to 4 stars. And I texted you, I said, I don't know if it's better than Columbus, but it's doing a different thing. So yeah. I can appreciate that it's doing something different. I did like it. I mean, stylistically, I love how he knows how to make something look pretty. Like I actually have it playing in the background as we're talking.
You can share your screen. Let's
see. Oh, I can't. No. It's just like, it's just playing kind of off to the side.
Oh, got it.
Yeah. I just kind of got it playing off to
the side. It is beautiful. Yeah. It's beautiful.
And I'm going to try to find this interview that he did on The Verge that Koganada did. I was going to try to find, to speak into your point of Asian-ness. I want to see. Let me see.
Yes, I think I see it.
The interviewer asked, you mentioned earlier that Yang is this sort of construct of Asianness. Talk to me about the concepts you really wanted to work with Yang's interiority. In the short story, this is Koganada. In the short story, all the flashbacks are from Yang's perspective. Jake's the one who is kind of recalling Yang, and it really centers him in trying to find value in Yang through his memories. We do have a memory. That key memory is Jake's, but everything else is really Yang's here. I wanted to focus on this sort of lesson of what Yang is valuing and attending to in this everyday space, even though the memories are just fragments and they don't have their own full narrative. The challenge, too, was figuring out what Yang was finding meaningful. I appreciate you asking this because there's two levels to it with Yang. And then the interview is like, oh, and he says, one is this feeling of displacement and this longing for a sense of place and his own sense of identity. I think if you're a person of color living in a predominantly white world, we all understand that sometimes that feeling of displacement is our base. that we're constantly constructing and trying to build off of. The other level is more about the things that we don't necessarily focus on, even in our research for answers and meanings. Sometimes the truth of what is meaningful is right in front of us and may be something as simple as just attending to mundane everyday things in a way that has a lot of personal value. Salada, this motherfucker, he's so smart.
He's very thoughtful. Yeah.
He's the real deal. Like, I mean, I appreciated that scene, like from the top where, you know, they're in the car and, like she's talking about the kids making, Mika is talking about the kids making fun of her for being Asian or something, about her parents not being Asian. And he's talking about grafting with the trees, and he's giving her an example of, you know, this is important too. You're just as important as they are, basically. And, you know, it just, it's interesting because in the short story, I read the short story, and it is that white perspective. It's just like, this white dude, his wife, they're white. And they just got this Asian kid like most do. And he also says in that interview, which is very good, where he talks about like there's some people that try to immerse their child. If their child is Asian and the parents are white, they'll try to immerse them a little bit. But some don't have a problem with just raising them white. You know, it's like no problem at all to do that. And I like the fact that, you know, Kira and Jake were like, OK, we got this Asian kid. We need somebody to look after this kid just because she's a kid and we got to work. Why don't we get this Asian guy, this Asian android, and let him give her these facts? Let her have somebody. Like, she calls him Gukka and she has these names for him. And also, like, he did this in Columbus too, where there's certain point. Aren't there certain points in this where you just hear the Chinese or?
Yeah, Mandarin.
Mandarin. You just hear the Mandarin and there's no subtitles. There's no explanation. Right. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's interesting. Yeah. The ways that the parents have Yang looking after Mika, but I think he's referred to as like a language robot, right? So it's also like his primary thing and these fun facts about China, but also language learning to teach her Mandarin so that she can have some connection to the culture that's beyond just trivia, but also through language.
Right.
And, you know, this question of like, so your girl, what's her name? Haley
Lou Richardson.
Haley Lou Richardson is a sort of a clone who he starts a relationship with covert, like furtively or secretly. And she says that, you know, he was happy overall, or like Jake has this question about like what Yang would talk about or what he would say, what he was feeling. And it's not that question or the question that he poses. Oh, was he like sad to not be human or something like that? Is Jake's perspective or question that he thinks to ask. And she says, no, but he wasn't sure if he was Chinese, you know. And I think that's really interesting because, it brings up a lot of these questions, and I'm not so sure about what its message is necessarily. And there is like, there's the blatant and explicit engagement with Chinese identity through Mika and through Yang, but there's also like these Japanese signifiers throughout, you know? And when I was the Q&A that came up after the screening with Koganade, it talked a lot about Ozu and the influence of Japanese filmmakers. And I know that Koganade has done video essays about Ozu, which I had meant to watch before today, but haven't really seen. Maybe you've seen them. So there's like this, there's references to, like, Japanese filmmaking, and then also like to Japanese and the architecture of the future in this place, like the home looks kind of like influenced by Japanese aesthetics and kind of like modern aesthetics. The fact that Jake, his job is to sell tea, which is makes connection to China potentially as well. But
Can I give you a factoid? Since you brought it up, those homes are called Eichler homes, and Eichler homes are examples of modernist architecture that has come to be known as California modern and typically feature glass walls, post and beam construction, and open floor plans in a style and indebted to Frank Lloyd Wright and Mies van der Rohe. This, you know, and they filmed this in Rockland County, which is like my stomping ground, not my stomping grounds, but where I do stand up a lot at Levity Live. And in that area, there are areas like that. And I'm sad that I didn't get to read for any roles in this film. Maybe I could have played the technician guy that was, I don't know, would have been nice.
That's funny. Wait, who is the conspiracy theorist guy? Or which one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
that was interesting.
It's because you obviously, if you watch Columbus, you know he's got this love of architecture. And there was some place. I hate that I don't even want to go down this rabbit hole, but there was a place in Connecticut that they did this screening of Columbus, and this really cool, interesting architectural place in Connecticut somewhere that I would have loved to have seen it at, but it just didn't work out. But I mean, where was I going with that? You brought up the fact about what else, the Asian-ness. I kind of like the fact that it brings up those questions and doesn't answer them necessarily.
It's interesting.
Because you get all these other, you get like, I think of that Spielberg flick. I think of AI. I think of this video game that came out a couple years ago called Detroit Become Human, about these androids that a bunch of them start to become sentient or gain their own autonomy, and what that means to society in the near future, blah, blah, blah. And it's always about conflict. You know, it's always about like uprising, when the video game trailer has a black android singing a Negro spiritual, it's going to be intense. And I saw that and I was like, oh shit, I'm getting this game. Like, I've talked about that a bunch of times on the show, but like, it's definitely a fresh take. Cause he said that somewhere in this interview, where there's been a lot of interesting stories and they've done this really well, but I wanted to talk about another aspect of it. Cause it's more than just it's a kid's toy, a kid's like, you know, and it's broken. It has meaning. And then a lot of times death, and my dad used to say this, death is a lot about less about the person that died, and it's more about the people that are left behind.
Right.
And that's kind of what this film is investigating. And those memories, you know, like when he's working with the tea, and it's interesting how it parallels to the sequences when he's like, you see those tea leaves when he's mixing it. That's a lot like the memory sequences when he's looking back at Yang's memory, like these little flakes, like that's all it is, like these. And sometimes they just come up and you just think about, you know, a lot of times when I think about my dad, there's things that could be like, or anything, a person that you miss or something like that. So, yeah, it's something. What did you think about that? The last third of the movie. I mean, maybe let's talk a little bit more about some other stuff that you had, but I wanted your insight on a couple things.
Yeah. Well, so we'll come back to the last third or the last act of the film, but just some of the things that you were bringing up about memory and humanness, and, you know, it's about Chineseness, but it's also about like, what is a human? What is an android? What is a clone? All those right. kinds of questions come up. And in the Q&A, it came up a lot about, you know, this is an android who feels more human than the human characters in the film and throughout, or, you know, like this is kind of way that they get to, it's showing the journey for Jake and even the wife played by
Jodie Turner-Smith.
Yeah, Kira. Mm-hmm. That they get to mourning. They get to mourning Yang because they don't immediately go there. Mika, obviously, her world is kind of shattered by the absence of this presence because he's kind of the only one that's really very present in her life,
right.
You know, and doing the actual like emotional work of raising this child, because it seems as though Jake is kind of checked out and Kira is very busy with a kind of seemingly very high ranking job that keeps her very busy. So, you know, the fact of Yang's existence without him, it's for Mika is like much more devastating than it is for the other two. For the other two, it means that they just have to take up the work of like raising their own kid a bit more, right? That's what they say,
and,
you know.
And you see those two pivotal moments with Jake with the tea and why he remembers why he loves tea from that documentary, which probably he's been disconnected from that. And then with Kira, the scene where he's talking about the butterflies and
the butterflies, yeah,
and stuff like that. So that's where she's like, oh, he did have this effect on me, you know.
Yeah,
that's how.
And so he talked.
Go ahead.
He talked a lot about those sequences and how slippery and kind of amorphous, and he represents the human, you know, realization or demonstration of memory. So in those moments, like there's repetition,
right.
The lines are said slightly different. It's like almost like, you know, as an actor, you would be familiar with like just different takes on the scene, sure. Right? But in this way, it's also like them, like the kind of instability of human memory to like really kind of represent what actually happened, whatever that might be. Whereas, you know, Yang's memories are sort of documentary, but they are also focused on these mundane everyday moments that otherwise would be missed mm-hmm. in the larger story of like, you know, people's lives of what they imagine. So he's focused on this kind of, everyday fabric, everyday texture of life that is sort of getting to some kinds of experiences of senses that the humans seem to take for granted, right? The whole tea thing, and he can't really taste it or smell it or any of those things, but he can kind of, he's trying to imagine what that would be like, or he's focused on those attention, on those details, attentive to those details. I did like just the science fiction thing and the kind of way that you're describing how those stories have been done. Mm-hmm. The way that conspiracy theorist technician is kind of like a whole nother story.
Spyware,
right?
Like, man. Yeah.
Which was interesting to like have that as almost like a red herring.
Right.
Like, oh, you know, the possibly Jake could be really, this could be like the beginning of Enemy of the State or something, but it's not. It's just like, that's a totally different film from what this is. And then the fact that at the end, they don't want him to be put on display in a museum, which becomes this other kind of opportunity that they have. But they do want to keep his memories for people to be able to experience, research, those kinds of things. So that's kind of going towards the last act of like, I don't know, it's more about their, I mean, it's the same kind of thing, right? It's this magical robot. He kind of facilitates this learning and arc, character arc for Jake, and mostly for Jake, but also for Kira, but for the couple, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to be what the resolution is in some ways. They're in mourning Yang, able to find their full humanity. And you know, it's a white man in the center again, Chris.
Well, the first one he had John Cho.
True.
And he had, you know, the movie's called After Yang, you know, it's like, it's about an Asian robot, and it's really to please this little Asian girl. So yeah. I'll give him a pass. There's a black woman in it.
Yeah. She's going good.
Having a sense of malaise, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, I hadn't seen her, and I know she was in Queen and Slim, right?
Yeah.
Jodie Turner-Smith.
And that Without Remorse, that Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, okay.
Flick.
Yeah. I think it would be kind of ungenerous to say that it's only that, you know, the story of Colin Farrell, but I think there is excitement to have Colin Farrell.
Oh yeah. That gets the movie probably made. That gets probably more A24 to be involved. I mean, it's crazy. You know, I watched him the day before in The Batman, him as unrecognizable as the Penguin. And then to see him in this, I mean, I think Colin Farrell's a great actor. I remember seeing him in Tigerland like years ago in like 2000 or 01, something like that. And just being like, oh, this dude's the real deal. Not just a pretty face, that Colin.
No.
I don't think he ever attached himself to that rocket ship anyway.
No, I think he was always, I mean, I don't know much about Colin Farrell. I'm going to admit. But I would say that, you know, Haley Lou Richardson is also kind of very, you know, Columbus is about Jun Cho and her character. Yes. Right.
Yeah. But it's mainly about her untethering herself from that town, her mother, and trying to live a life, that she wanted to live, you know, to get a kid, you know, be, to give it a shot. Cause it's one thing to go after something and then fail, but it's another thing to just never do anything.
Right.
And it's like something her mother had to let go. And then she had to let go, but it was mainly her decision.
I think the kind of marriage of, you know, modernist aesthetics, and which can be thought of as like very intellectual or cerebral and not having much, you know, emphasis on emotion and heart.
Yeah.
This is what's key to Koganata's, you know, filmmaking, those kinds of marriage of those two in these genres, whether it be with the focus on modernist architecture or science fiction and, you know, these age old questions about, does an android have a soul, or do androids dream of electric sheep kinds of things, right?
I never heard that, electric sheep. That's funny.
What is it? That's the Blade Runner.
Okay.
William Gibson, right? William Gibson short story, I think. Or no, that's not right. Phil K. Dick, sorry. Do androids dream of electric sheep? That was what Blade Runner was based on, that short story, I think. You know, I think that for that, and then he does it so virtuosically, like it's,
yeah,
when I first, like the first scenes, I was like, oh my God, this is so beautiful. Like the dance game that they're playing, yeah, and the choreography. And I was like, oh gosh, this is sumptuous, man. This is just like, so it's just like the screen, and just so vibrant. And I just want to like be in this moment.
Right before the title card, he keeps on dancing.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yo. And in the short story, they're like eating breakfast and he keeps banging his head into the bowl of cereal and just like, and they're like, yo, what's going on with Yang? But man, like it's so, he's got a great way. Like even in Columbus, there's a probably, I don't know. Like, one of my favorite scenes in there what makes him an auteur, where she's explaining, like Haley Lou Richardson's explaining to John Cho about what she likes about a particular building. And he's like, no, don't give me that. Give me what you really feel. And she does it. And then they mute her. And then one of the only times you hear a score is just a score playing over her being muted, talking about the building. And it's like, that's beautiful. Yeah. And then these shots, these just beautiful shots with a heartbeat attached to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it's a real skill. Like I'm just kind of like looking over at the screen now where it's just, you know, like they kind of got it where you're, where they're talking to somebody on like a FaceTime type apparatus, but it's really just a direct address to the
He said that was his Ozu cam. Yeah, like the kind of way that the character is just looking directly into the audience, like directly into the camera.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I want to ask you about the Haley Lou Richardson character, Ada. She's a clone. she had a relationship with Yang. But then she's a clone of what, like somebody. How does that work? That kind of confused me a little bit.
The clone stuff was confusing to me too. And there was also this moment where, you know, one of the helper robots, for lack of a better phrasing, of the neighbors, like Jake is asking around, like if they know this person, Ada. He asked the neighbors, and then their helper robot says something like, well, there's the daughter, their robot daughter, their android daughter, I think, says,
The Clifton Collins, his kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're two, the twins are clones.
Oh,
The daughter is, I guess, just human or whatever.
Oh, is that right? Cause I don't know why I read her as android or something too.
From
you're probably right. Yeah, I was confused by that too.
Okay. Because I was trying to figure out, like, because because even Wikipedia, I was trying to see what they said, and I'm not sure that that's right. Like, back in, like, he was an android from the 1900s or something.
Like, the timeline didn't really, did you know what time we were even in?
I'm assuming we're just in the near future, but then they go back and, like, Wikipedia says Jake talks to Yang's previous owner, Nancy, who mentions that Yang was not a new product. I think Nancy said, like, yeah, I didn't get him from Brothers and Sisters. She got him from somewhere else, like the discount place. And
she was the interim owner between them and the much longer owner before then, family that he lived with before then.
Right. And it says they reveal that Yang had lived an entire life before either Jake or Nancy owned him, one in which he developed a relationship with a woman named Ada. The older Ada is revealed to have died in a car accident. And afterwards, Yang cared for her mother until she died of old age. I don't know if that's true. The younger.
Yeah. It's unclear because Ada in the timeline of the film says that she was the great grandniece great grand aunt or something. Right.
Yeah.
I was really confused by the clone thing. So I was trying to get to that moment where he goes to the neighbor's house played by Clifton Collins. And one of the teenagers says something like that Jake had a prejudice against clones.
Yes. Yeah.
And I didn't know where that was kind of a thread that was just like left dangling. You know, I didn't really have a sense of how that connected or how clones were different than androids and like if there were different rights or why anybody would even want in the clone.
Book, the book, I, cause the book was saying something like Kira's sister was gonna have one, and I think Jake was just like, I don't know about that. I think he was just kind of like, I don't know about that stuff, just being kind of skeptical because Kira's sister and her husband were gonna have clones, and then I think maybe he was just kind of uneasy about him or was just kind of weird, and then the daughter picked up on that. That's what my vibe. That's what I got.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's helpful to have that information from the. Okay.
But I think in the film it was just like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just that, I think for the film, it's just referencing that Yang had even more secrets than anyone knew. Like no one completely knew Yang.
Yeah.
And he didn't reveal that he had this whole lifetime before. How much he had access to that is even kind of like up for speculation.
Yeah.
I did want to talk a little bit about the timing or like how, what future it is set in, because there was reference to like, there's been some kind of huge environmental disaster, some kind of like cataclysmic events that have happened to make it so that people live differently. That is kind of a background of like, there seems to have been some kind of disaster that has led to this kind of, you know, way of living, and it's undefined.
Yeah.
What this way of living means, but yeah.
This interview that I read, like right before we started talking, it was saying that Kira was working on something, and it had something to do with the trees, about like, I'll see if I can find it, but it was just like about like, say, okay, so he's asked, the interviewer asked, this is going to bug me if I don't ask you since you brought it up, but let's double back to Kira for a second. What is she working on exactly? And he says, so in this world, in this city, they realize that the trees and plants need to be a vital part of their environment. Initially, the idea was that there was going to be this sort of city in a forest, and you can still see elements of that. I had this idea, and there's a scientific word for it, and we won't go into it now, but it's basically the natural cycle of leaves falling. In this future, that natural process poses a danger to this city because it creates all sorts, all this debris. At this time, though, everyone in the world longs for seasons, the change of the seasons. This issue may feel a bit aesthetic, but Kira was creating a way for trees to continue to express the passage of time, only without their leaves falling. It was meaningful to me because I think so much of this work and work that I care about is about us recognizing a passage of time. And I think that is the thing that can often attune us. I'd written all that into the script, but it just kind of became its own thing. And I thought I just was so, and I just thought I was so fascinated by it. Hmm. So I guess she was just working on a project that was going to help that, but it was just like another side story in this very lean movie. That's like an hour and a half, like an hour and change. Not that long.
Yeah.
So it's kind of,
it's really like, interesting about the time passing thing though.
Yeah.
You know,
he's art house Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan's all about time.
You know, one of the only Coconata video essays that I felt compelled to watch was this one he did about Richard Linklater in Time. Okay. Time and Richard Linklater's films, which I had opened up to. Oh, yeah, here it is. So, yeah, he is definitely always thinking about time. So that's interesting context about the trees and how intricate he is in all the different parts of the film.
And I'm wondering what you just kind of alluded to a little earlier. I'm wondering, did it even really matter about who he was with before, how old he was? It's more just about like he has a life that, or memories that preceded Jake and Kira and Mika and Nancy and everybody. It's just like he had so much more of a life. And, you know, I was talking to a friend about, you know, we both lost a parent recently. And I mentioned it on the podcast where like I saw like one of my dad's old work IDs and I was looking at it. It was him, but it was like, who's that dude? I want to know who that is. I want to know that guy. Yeah. Like, and it's kind of like that. That's a part of him that I'll never know. And then there's a part, you know, there's parts that even being his son that him and my mother, you know, that I didn't know about. So it's just an interesting. It's very interesting. Like, I guess it doesn't matter, but it was just like this all at once. That montage was just like, okay, well, what I'm trying to track this. My brain just trying to, that's that last third of the movie was just kind of like, what is this? What are you trying to say? Like, okay, he did have that relationship with Ada and then he quote unquote found her, that he found the clone.
Right.
I mean, you could just count that to movie serendipity. I don't have a problem with that. But then just like the old stuff going back. And then was Ada was just like helping out that old lady, the mom, or she was just, I don't know.
Yeah. I felt like Ada was a family member.
Yeah.
And someone who he loved.
Yeah.
And someone who he lost.
Yeah.
And who knows if he, you know, found Ada in the contemporary timeline on purpose, or if he knew that he was meeting her.
Right.
It's just kind of like this wisdom of, you know, this wisdom of the body and of fate that the film is positing even this android has.
Hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, to get to that point that you had mentioned about your dad's ID, you know, like that kind of moment makes me think of that. when he's in it, when Jake is in Yang's memories and he sees himself in a mirror, he's got this really long hair and he looks like very different. And it's like, whoa, who's this Yang? You know, like he looks so, different. And then like, that he was going to rock shows and, you know, living this kind of other life, even in the time that they were sharing together, is interesting. Koganada did say something about how the family, in the ways that we see it in the beginning of the film, is regarding Yang as sort of like this child and sort of like this wonder. And he has this, you know, disposition, which is very positive and kind of childlike wonder. But he's like a grandfather. He's like an ancestor in the he's lived for much longer than anybody else in the family. And so there was this kind of commentary there about they didn't know the gift that they had of having this kind of like very wise, very older person in their family household that they didn't realize had that kind of wealth of experience. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just kind of interesting.
Fascinating flick. I mean, I kind of, this is the same thing happened to me last week with, I was talking about to Tim about a more of a mainstream flick, The Batman, that I liked it more after talking to him about it. And I mean, I did like After Yang, but then now that we're talking about it even more, it's just making me appreciate it a lot more. You know, it's a really, and I mean, I was, you know, he's one of my favorite new filmmakers, you know. I'm never gonna not check out what he's doing. So
there were a lot of people waiting for time with Koganada after the film and after Q&A.
Oh yeah, I can imagine.
I saw him. People.
You did you try to talk to him?
No, I did not. I would only try to get like an autograph for you, Chris. I didn't, you know, am I gonna
if you do a deep dive into my Instagram, I was at the New York, I don't know if that was a premiere, but that was like opening weekend of the film at the IFC Center. And he did a Q&A and it was Haley Lou Richardson was there. The Culkin kid was there.
Kieran
was there. Yeah. So it was pretty neat. It was really cool. It was cool to get to see him. So I hope it's doing well, and I hope more people go check it out, because you know, we talk about spoiling, but it's really something to be experienced. I did tell during the run of the play that I was in last year, a couple of people did watch Columbus and they did like it. So
yeah, I mean, he's obviously someone to keep an eye out for, and you know, I think that the new series that he's doing with Justin Chon is Pachinko, and it's going to be on Hulu.
Okay.
So that'll be interesting to check out.
So he's getting his Barry Jenkins on. He's going to do a
Sweeping Saga. Yeah. Chronicles the hopes and dreams of a Korean immigrant family across four generations. Yeah. That's likely going to be a conversation starter. I'm sure that like the Korean American or Korean diaspora is going to have a lot to say about a film like that. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Because even like what pisses, I saw this, I don't want to get too much into it, but we'll wrap it up. And I'll get, you know, some final thoughts from you. This film, Turning Red, this new is it a Pixar flick that's coming out?
I've seen advertisements for it.
On Disney Plus on Friday. We're recording this on Wednesday, March 9th. And on the 11th, it's supposed to premiere on Disney Plus. And it's about this young girl. I guess she's like prepubescent and she's an Asian girl, and she's got, when she gets some kind of emotion, she turns into this like panda, like red kind of panda thing. And there was some article that one of people a film critic that I like a lot, David Chen, what is his podcast? Oh God. Anyway, David Chen, I've mentioned him a bunch of times. A friend of Tim Hall's, / Filmcast is where he's from. And he posted this article from somebody reviewing the movie. Like, he took out a screenshot of an excerpt from it and was saying like, oh, it's hard for me to relate because it's like something something, something, something Asian, but I couldn't relate because it was Asian. It's like, come on, dog. Really?
That's wild.
Yeah, I hate that. And he, you know, he rightfully went in on him, but I just, that stuff just really pisses me off, man.
Yeah.
I hate that. Because we do everything, and it's not much to find the humanity in these characters, whether regardless of what color they are. We're finding humanity in these people, and we can relate to them. And we talk about movies, all types of movies on this show, and never did we ever say, "Oh, I can't relate to that guy because this character because he doesn't look like me." You know.
Well, it's just. It's silly. I mean, if you're only watching films to relate to people, characters, I don't know what you're doing, first of all. And then just like, it's just racism. It's just straight up racism.
Yeah.
So about Pachinko, I don't know, man, because I wasn't a huge fan of the, you know, I was going to watch Blue Bayou for you because we were interested in talking about it, but I watched Gook before that. And I don't know if we talked about that either, but
Blue Bayou was solid.
Yeah.
I didn't like the ending, but it was just, I think it's just being invested in the character and just being disappointed in the outcome, but not the film, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, fuck, man, I wish X would have happened instead of Y. But
yeah. Well, I think that when trying to get as Justin Chan is like someone who's very controversial in even the Korean American community. And then you also get it from like the racist. So I don't know.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I didn't know he was controversial. I just knew he made good movies.
Did not like Blue Bayou in the kind of like Instagram space that I'm in. And then I can kind of see why I didn't see that one. I didn't like 2017's Gook. I didn't like that one.
Oh, you did? Okay.
No. But we can talk about that another time. Let's talk about it when we come back to Pachinko.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So final thoughts, you're saying?
Yeah, what are some final thoughts? I mean, I really like this one. It's hard to live up to Columbus, but I mean, I wasn't asking it to do that, but I thought it's a very good movie. And now I'm looking at this sequence now. They're showing it, you know, I'm up to the point, you know, where they're showing all this past stuff, but it doesn't make sense to me. I'm trying to figure that shit out. I don't know.
What do you mean? Doesn't make sense.
Figure out who's this Asian boy and this white woman.
Oh, that's that family from before. That's the first family.
So that's the first family. And and Yang was with them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He was their, you know, language android.
Okay. So that's all that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Haley Lou Richardson's Ada helped out.
She was like a family member, I thought. I thought she was like an aunt or like someone's like sister. Okay. That's what I took it as.
Okay.
Like that she was just in the general community or whatever and connected to this family somehow. Okay. Maybe a niece. I thought of the mom, maybe, I think is what I was going from.
Because the mom is getting older and then they're going to show Ada.
Yeah,
and that's like the first time. But then they go back. So
she's
like from an agency or something, and she's helping her with their physical therapy.
Oh,
and so this Ada,
she was a worker, like she was somebody who was hired to help.
A healthcare worker.
I was confused about that. Then I thought it was just like, yeah, that is quite confusing. Then Chris.
Yeah, and then they go back where she's looking like she's got an old ass dress on from like the 1900s or some shit.
You know, if climate disaster happens, maybe we will be wearing clothes like that. It's a thing, you know. Yeah,
well, that's the basis of Horizon Zero Dawn.
I don't know that, but yeah. So this movie is really interesting for thinking through science fiction themes. You know, my area of interest is like digital media studies. And so, yeah, I was really maybe more interested in After Yang than Columbus in some ways.
Oh, I can see that. It's an easier way in. It's an easier, you know what I mean? Like it's sci-fi is easy with an android. What are these people going to do with this android as opposed to this interesting, quaint town in the midst of Klan country.
Yeah, in Indiana. I mean, I enjoyed, you know, Columbus. I did. Yeah. But it's this is one that I can probably teach in my classes from, you know, in the future. And just I think that he's always kind of improving or like working on different things, visualizations, expanding. Yeah. And it's an exciting time in his career, I think, for how he, and it's just exciting to see what like a video essay career can kind of train someone to become director wise. So that's just kind of interesting, formally. But yeah, and the questions that it raises around like Chinese-ness and like Asian-ness in the science fiction genre is like, you know, sadly, there's not like a huge amount of well-funded mainstream science fiction films that can that do that. You know, science fiction's really expensive. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting film, and I'm glad to have watched it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Veronica, this has been a joy as always, a nice respite from my day to day. I always enjoy talking films with you and nerding out. Where can people find you?
So if you're interested to learn more about me, you can listen to the previous podcast episodes on Mundane, a festival that I've been on. But no, veronicabutedis.com, and I'll update it, I promise.
Well, Veronica, joy as always. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And I will talk to you next time. Take it easy, everybody.